calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border, on terrestrial radio stations, regular radio stations from California to North Carolina, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, Live 365's American FM. Welcome to our program. Our toll-free number, 1-866-889-8894, if you would like to call in. A lot of interesting stuff in the news today. Is it possible that your bottled water is killing you? Are the Republicans, in some levels, in some places, starting to say equality, teaching equality, is something teachers shouldn't be doing? Shouldn't? Teachers needn't advocate equality? The latest on John Bolton. John Bolton, it turns out the guy is not just, kind of a serial wacko. He is a serial stalker. We'll get back to that. And just a pile of news for the day. However, we'll start with George Bush. He unveils a new Social Security plan. During a speech at Soldiers and Sailors Memorial on the University of Pittsburgh campus, President Bush detailed his newest plan to save Social Security, which is projected to produce budget shortfalls sometime around 2034 because of his flagging support in recent polls, some showing approval ratings as low as 35%. Bush's administration felt the current plan needed some work. Under the new plan, instead of Americans investing a large percentage of savings in personal accounts in the stock market, this report, by the way, by Jordan Bauer and Michael Gradasek, from bbspot.com. Under the new plan, instead of Americans investing a large percentage of savings in personal accounts in the stock market, that money will instead be diverted into lottery accounts. In these lottery accounts, the funds will be distributed across Quick Picks, Cash for Life, and Powerball tickets. According to Bush, hundreds of Americans will not only be able to retire early, but they will do so with, quote, jillions of dollars, end quote. In his speech earlier today, he dismissed critics who said his plan lacked any common sense. Bush said, "With the way the economy is going, many Americans would feel more secure knowing that today, tomorrow, or even next Tuesday could be the day they can finally afford to fill their SUVs again." He continued, "Cheney wanted to do that other lottery where we make Social Security work by condemning a certain number of Americans to death so the rest can afford to retire, but I reminded him that after we bring the draft back next fall, we won't need to do that." A little levity for the day, I suppose. It's we all need that. Anyhow, and to the folks in our chat room, I say good morning. I haven't been able to get into the chat room, but I will during the first break here. If you want to drop by our chat room, it's www.tomhartman.com. We'll take you into the chat room. We're doing quick computer handoff here right now, and I just couldn't get to it. This story, though, about teachers advocating equality. This boggled my mind. This is at the moment it's a local story, but it's also one of those stories that I suspect may be being played out all across the country in local school districts. This is the Reich's agenda. Betsy Hammond wrote this for the Oregonian. The headline: Teachers Needn't Advocate Equality. Oregon cannot require teachers to advocate social justice and equality because that would violate teachers' constitutional rights. Say what? What? Teachers can't advocate social justice and equality. What had happened was the state wanted to have you're trying to come up with standards for teachers, right? And one of the standards was a standard called cultural competence. They wanted teachers to have what they call cultural competence, which means, well, here's the definition from the State Teachers Association, or the law, as it were. Their aim, it's well, the report from the meeting says, quote, "Cultural competence entails actively challenging the status quo and advocating for equality and social justice. Well, the head of the House Education Committee, the chairwoman Linda Flores in Oregon, this is a state thing, called up the Legislative Council and said, is this legal that we can require teachers to know how to teach, to actively challenge the status quo and advocate for equality and social justice? And Cindy Hurt, the senior deputy legislative counsel, the lawyer, said, no. If a teacher must advocate for social justice and equity, that rule effectively regulates the content of the speech of a teacher. You get this? I mean, they want to regulate the speech of teachers in a whole bunch of different ways. Well, we don't want teachers to use these words. We don't want teachers to teach these things. We don't want teachers talking about evolution. We do want them talking about creationism. We want to make sure that they don't talk about sex education. We don't want them talking about condoms, but we do want them talking about they've got their whole long list. We don't want them talking about homosexuality. We do want them but when it comes to teaching equality and social justice, no. That would be an infringement of teachers' rights of free speech. If we made sure that their ability to do that, their understanding of that, was considered part of their training, right? It was considered part of the standards that we would hold them to. This is mind-boggling. This is mind-boggling. And, you know, I wonder if this is happening in your state as well. Scientists say, this is the plastic story. Let me get my bottle.
It is. Yes, indeed. I have here a bottle of genuinely pure, true Alaskan water.
Tastes good. I remember 2-3 years ago, the story came out about how soft plastics had a plasticizing or a softening chemical in them, softer plastics, which might have negative health consequences. And therefore, I stopped drinking anything out of the soft bottles. In fact, they were concerned about these squeeze bottles, these soft squeeze bottles that bikers, you know, long-distance bikers and runners and things use, suggesting, and baby bottles and whatnot, suggesting that they may be introducing plasticizing chemicals, these softening chemicals, which had an adverse effect on human health. And so everybody, kind of the industry, everybody moved to polycarbonate plastic, which is that clear, rigid plastic. Now we see evidence is mounting that a chemical in plastic may be risky in the small amounts that seep from bottles and food packaging, according to a report to be published this week in a scientific journal. Authors of the report, who reviewed more than 100 studies, urged the Environmental Protection Agency to reevaluate the risks of bisphenol A and consider restricting its use. This is called BPA, is the short tag for this. BPA has been detected in nearly all human bodies tested in the United States. You have it. I have it. I just drank some of it. Now, the plot thickens. I'm no pun intended. Well, the chemical doesn't thicken. The plot thickens. The focus, BPA has been the focus. This is an article from the Los Angeles Times, by the way, by Marla Cohn. The plastics chemical is the focus of one of the most contentious debates involving industrial compounds that can mimic sex hormones. Toxicologists say exposure to man-made hormones skews the developing reproductive systems and brains of newborn animals and could be having the same effect on human fetuses and young children. Turns out this stuff, BPA, is what's called estrogenic. An estrogenic compound is a chemical that suppresses testosterone and enhances or imitates, depending on the chemical, estrogen. And, you know, we've seen all these reports recently about women who are taking estrogen and they're at higher risk for cancer. In fact, they're saying to women, you know, postmenopausal women, don't take estrogen unless you absolutely have to, you know, get through with the hot flashes or whatever. If you can get through it without it, great, because it increases the risk of heart attacks, it increases the risk of cancer, it increases the risk of death. Not, you know, death is not like a good good outcome. It's not a good consequence. Well, the plastics industry says, this is no problem. The EPA says that this is below safety threshold. Well, it turns out that for this chemical, there are no regulations. None. This chemical has been around for about 40 to 50 years. Ever since about the 1950s, they've been using this chemical. And here's the amazing thing. Von Saul, a reproductive biologist at the University of Missouri in Columbia, he says there's now an overwhelming weight of evidence that the plastics compound is harmful. He says this is a snowball running down a hill where the evidence is accumulating at a faster and faster rate. You can't open a scientific journal related to sex hormones and not read an article that would just floor you about this chemical. I am quoting here from one of the top scientists in the country in this field. He says this is a phenomenally potent chemical as a sex hormone. And then he points out there have been 115 studies done on this. Okay, 115 studies. Of those, 11 of the studies were funded by the chemical companies. 104 of the studies were either funded by government programs, unaffiliated with anybody, right? Just, you know, government grants or whatnot, or non-industry sources like universities. Of the 104 government-funded and non-industry studies, 90% of them reported, quote, harmful effects, end quote, from this chemical. However, the 11 studies funded by the chemical industry, the plastics industry, the 11 studies funded by the chemical companies, 100% of them, all 11 of them, found no risk. Nothing to worry about, my friends. Everything's just fine. There's nothing to worry about. The chemical used in polycarbonate plastic manufacture for half a century is not subject to any bans. Polycarbonate plastics useful in items such as baby bottles because they are durable, lightweight, and shatter resistant cannot be made without BPA. So here we are. Do you want the plastics? Do you want the side effects that go with it? This is just, you know, another example in my mind of where we should be applying the precautionary principle. In Europe, the precautionary principle is the norm. The absolute norm in Europe is if you know that it's dangerous, then if you don't know whether or not it's dangerous, then you check it out and you have to prove safety. In the United States, instead, we wait until we have proven danger by having people drop dead or having cancer epidemics, and then we do something about it. And the Europeans are looking at us going, you guys are nuts. You guys are plain old flat-out nuts. And we're going, no, we're not. We're just corporate. That's all. We're just in the pockets of the big companies. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lindball.
This is the old...
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Yeah, just a little truth, please. That would be nice. That was his dirty little bill. In his radio address this weekend, President Bush called on Congress to pass new energy legislation. That was the Center for American Progress, saying American families and small businesses across the country are feeling the pinch from rising gas prices. Yeah, this, oh my. This, we'll get back to that. First, however, greetings to the folks in our chat room. You can get to it by going to TomHartman.com. Click Live Chat. It'll take you into the message board. Click Live Chat again. It'll take you into the chat room. Our telephone number, if you'd like to be on the program, 1-866-889-8894. Toll free all across the United States of America. And time for a Berlusconi alert. Yes, indeed. Silvio Berlusconi. You will recall Mr. Berlusconi, a small-time crook and businessman in Italy. How can I say he's a crook? Well, because his business partner's in prison. And he, if he loses his job, will be under indictment. That the national anthem of Italy there, by the way. He has resigned. Now, it's not quite the way it sounds. It's not quite the way it sounds. What it means is that he's calling for a vote. They have a different political system than we do here. And I suspect most Americans don't understand what it means. You say Berlusconi resigned. Where I was going with Berlusconi. Let me finish that thought first. So this small-time businessman, he buys a TV, he buys a radio station, then he buys another radio station, then he buys a TV station, buys another TV station, buys a newspaper, buys another radio station, buys a radio network, buys a TV network, buys another radio network, buys another newspaper, and pretty soon he owns virtually all of the media in Italy, virtually all of the radio stations, the television stations, and most of the newspapers. And then he decides to run for political office. What a surprise. And amazingly, he wins. Who would have thought? I mean, who could have imagined that the guy who owned the newspapers, the radio, and the television stations would have actually won? But, you know, the good news, I suppose, is that maybe he's not going to make it through. We'll see how this thing plays out. But his resignation means that there's going to be elections. And really what this could be a way of his consolidating his power. This is his plan. What he's trying to do, what he's hoping to do, is reconsolidate his power, bring together a new coalition, to have new elections so that, because the prime minister is appointed by the parliament, and so there'll be new elections for the parliament and all that kind of, we'll see how it plays out. Is this Berlusconi's last stand, or is this simply the beginning of a new incarnation of a corrupt old politician? Who knows? But we shall find out. Back to this bankruptcy bill. I'm sorry, back to the gas thing. Gas today costs an average of $2.28 per gallon. This is from the Progress Report, the Center for American Progress. $2.28 per gallon, up 6 cents in a week and 50 cents from this time last year. Americans are mad! Mad! But one of the things that I noticed that was really surprising to me, frankly, and I guess I haven't been tracking diesel fuel prices for years. We used to have a diesel car way back, 25 years ago, I guess it was. And one of the reasons we bought it was because diesel fuel was a third or two-thirds of the cost. It was a third off the cost of gasoline. And now in many places, in many parts of the United States, diesel fuel is actually more expensive than gasoline. So it's tough on the truckers, particularly tough on the truckers. And the trucking industry has reconfigured itself so that to the maximal extent possible, they try to screw the independents and stick it to the individuals, the men and women who are driving the trucks, and or many of the owner operators, rather than having the corporations handle it or absorb it. This is the wonders of deregulation, right? Whenever a Republican says deregulation, you know what it means. It means it's gonna help the big corporations. It's gonna screw the little guy. 37% described it as extremely important for Congress and Bush to overhaul Social Security, right? Yeah, his main priority. But in the meantime, gas prices going through the roof. And what's he doing about it? Welfare for Exxon. 29 minutes past the hour.
Ever wonder who coined the phrase "we eliminate"?
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Dedicate that to our trucker listeners.
Airman, I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I did my share, man. I've been everywhere.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And the House's Dirty Little Bill is the headline in the Progress Report today. What a great, great headline, because this bill is going to make the air dirtier. It's going to hand $8 billion in corporate welfare to the oil and gas industry, which right now is showing absolute record profits, more cash than they've ever had before. I mean, ever had before. Go back to John Rockefeller. They've never had this kind of cash. We're talking, you know, $20, $30 billion sitting in the bank. Record profits, record cash flows. Why? Well, because they can say, well, you know, the price of a barrel of oil is now over $50, so we just have to raise the price of gasoline to $2. But wait a minute, you're raising the price of gas more than the cost of oil went up. Well, that just helps us increase our profits. You know, it's that's life. And by the way, we need some tax incentives.
Incentives, yes. Now, the incentives mean what?
Well, you can call it corporate welfare if you want, I suppose, just as long as you give it to us.
Yes, and $500 million for renewables, that's the bone that they threw. Wouldn't surprise me at all if that wasn't even in the original energy legislation. just come on. And tucked into the New York Times pointed this out yesterday. They did a great story on this. Tucked into the energy bill in a section titled Miscellaneous. Miscellaneous. I mean, this is a great big bill, right? And way down at the bottom, guess who wrote it? Joe Barton, Republican of Texas, the tried and true friend of Enron, a loyal, you know, loyal friend of Enron, good old Joe. And he puts in this little thing that says, one of the most significant changes in the Clean Air Act in 15 years. We're going to radically change the Clean Air Act in the energy bill. And we're not going to tell you about it. This is what the cons are up to now. I mean, this is the new con. Yes, indeed. Let's say it exempts states from having to clean up their dirty air if some of their pollution comes from other heavily polluted areas. In other words, everybody. I mean, there is air pollution on the West Coast coming from China. There's air pollution, and well, you don't have to clean up your air until China cleans up their air. And, of course, New York State, oh, you don't have to clean up your air until Ohio cleans up their air. And Ohio, you don't have to clean up your air until Colorado cleans up their air. Colorado, you don't have to clean up your air until California. California, you can wait for China. And we're all back to China. The downwind states don't have to meet clean air standards until the upwind states have been cleared up. And you get this dog chasing its tail forever. It's just off into bureaucratic limbo, and you know, forever and ever, and that's the end of the story. And you know, is that the kind of energy bill that we want? It also shields the manufacturers of MTBE. We talked about this earlier last week. MTBE has been detected in 1,861 water systems in 29 states, serving 45 million Americans. You get that? 45 million Americans are drinking MTBE. This is a chemical that is so hydrophilic, I think is the word, hydrophilic, water-seeking. It gloms onto water. This is a chemical that so loves water. It gets into groundwater, and boom, it's part of the water supply. It's in the wells. You can't get it out. There's nothing new. Although these corporations, some of the richest oil giants in the country, have known since the early 1980s their product was a water pollutant, they are refusing to clean up the water their product has fouled. States around the country have been forced to sue the corporations to get them to take responsibility. Now the right wing in Congress... This is from the Center for American Progress Report. With a staunch support of Representatives Tom DeLay and Barton, wants to shield these companies by waiving all MTBE liability lawsuits retroactively. They want to go back 2 years. They want to go back to September of 2003 and say, if you sued any time after September 2003, which is when this story really came out, when it really became a story, if you sued any time after that, you're out of luck. Sorry. And then, of course, you know, let's drill in Alaska. That's in the bill. The wonders of Alaskan drilling. It's going to take 10 years before we can get around to it. I mean, you know, if we started right now, we wouldn't have oil from Alaska for 10 years. And how much are we going to get? Enough to supply the United States for 6 months. Now, that's not a small amount of oil. We use a lot of oil here. But it's also not going to solve any problems.
because we got to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. Well, the rate of our consumption of oil right now is increasing so rapidly and so substantially, in large part because of the $100,000 a year tax exemption on SUVs. Yes, you heard me right. If you own a small business, and there are millions of them in America, millions. You know, CPAs incorporate, doctors incorporate, dentists incorporate, most professionals incorporate, and a lot of, you know, and your corner auto mechanic, you know, I mean, there's, you know, in Vermont we had a guy who sharpened chainsaws. The guy sharpened chainsaws. He probably made $3,000-$4,000 a year doing it. He did it on the side, but he'd set up a company to do it. I mean, you know, people set up companies to do these kinds of things. And if you own a company and you put the vehicle in the name of the company, you can take a $100,000 tax deduction if the vehicle weighs more than 6,000 pounds. I kid you not. And we wonder why there's so many SUVs being sold out there. Are they going to do anything about it? No, they're not even talking about it. They're not even talking about it. And then you get an amendment to this last tax bill, I believe it was, to raise the CAFE standards, the corporate average fuel efficiency standards. That is the average fleet standards. If you take Ford Motor Company, for example, or General Motors or Chrysler or whatever, pick a company, and you take all of their cars, from their gas guzzlers to their super efficient cars, and you average out their fuel economy, right now it has to be 27.5 miles per gallon or better. And this proposal was between now and 2014, which is, you know, over the next 10 years, basically, 9 years, let's increase this up to 33 miles per gallon. Now, 33 miles per gallon is not that big a deal for average fleet. I mean, it's just not that big a deal. Let's take it up to 33 miles per gallon. And the Republicans in the House said, what? What? Are you kidding? We can't do this. We can't afford it. Nah, shot it right down. Shot it right down. And then, of course, you've got Halliburton, again, this back to the bill, Halliburton developed this technique called fractional drilling. It gets out oil from wells that are having a hard time, the older wells. And you drill into them and you inject hot water, you inject steam down into them and blow stuff out of them and you know, it's another way of drilling, right? And this is incredible. It produces mind-boggling levels of pollution in a lot of areas because it just kind of blows this stuff all over underground where it gets into aquifers and it contaminates wells and things like that. And, of course, the Republicans want to make sure that if somebody is using hydraulic fracturing, the drilling, and they happen to contaminate somebody's water, tough luck. We're going to exempt this from future regulation. Seriously. This, no problem. We'll just exempt it. And then, you know, Joe Barton, by the way, the guy who was the author of perhaps the most outrageous part of this, the part that allows dirty air to exist forever, the author of the most outrageous section of the bill, which exists to protect the profits of the energy industry, was Representative Joe Barton of Texas, the chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Little wonder that Barton sides with industry interests. During the past decade, the industry has been very, very good to him, to the tune of nearly $1.5 million. Since 1994, oil and gas companies have given Barton more than $750,000. Gee, you think that might affect his vote? I mean, and this is a member of Congress. Electrical companies have kicked in an additional $673,104. $1.5 million from the oil industry? Incredible. Absolutely incredible. It's just what we need. And then John Bolton. I can't let you go without telling you about this here in this first hour of the program. John Bolton, Melody Townsend. I suspect that this is going to be another Anita Hill. I suspect Aha. Uh-huh. I suspect that this is gonna come back and bite them. Melody Talzel is coming out and saying John Bolton is a serial stalker. Those are not her words, they're mine, but she says that he's pathological. His behavior in 94 wasn't just unforgivable, it was pathological. We'll get into that in a few minutes. Let's take a few phone calls first. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Ken in Illinois is on the line. Hey, Ken, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for being there. I'm one of the truck drivers that listens to your show every day, and I love it.
Thank you.
I want to make sure that you're being accurate on that tax break for the SUVs. Are you allowed to deduct $100,000 even if you only spend $60,000 on the vehicle?
No, no. Yeah, if you only spend $60,000, you can deduct $60,000.
Okay.
I'll tell you how the way I learned about this, Ken, is just amazing. Louise and I owned a business, an ad agency in Atlanta. This is about 8 or 9 years ago, 10 years ago. And the company had made a small profit that year. It made about a $20,000 profit. I mean, it's small by, big company standards. And our CPA came to us and he said, you've got this profit. He said, why don't you buy a new car? Because our car was like 4 or 5 years old. And he said, and besides that, we were moving at that time from Atlanta up to Vermont. And he said, but it's got to weigh more than 6,000 pounds, and you can put it in the company's name, and you can deduct up to $24,000. You can buy a vehicle that's worth up to $24,000 and just write it off. And, we can reverse this tax. Just otherwise, you're going to have to pay it in taxes. And so we did. We actually did, because we were moving. The house that we moved to in Vermont had a half-mile-long dirt driveway, and it was on the side of a mountain, and we needed a four-wheel drive vehicle. So we bought a Land Rover, which weighs 6,003 pounds. I mean, these companies know this. They know about the tax deduction, so they make
them
exactly like that. And we were able to pull $24,000 off our tax return that year. The corporation was. The company was. And,
sure,
I
understand.
It's incredible.
It's just that I love your show, and I don't want it to be criticized, and I just need for you to be a little bit more careful of the hyperbole there, because you're not allowed $100,000. You're allowed the cost of the vehicle.
Up to the value of the vehicle, right.
If you just park the vehicle, then you're being environmentally conscious if you don't ever use it. And, I'm the kind of guy that pays my taxes every year, and I don't even file a return. I want them to keep it all.
Yeah.
Just be careful with the information you give out, please, Tom, because I love your show.
Good point, Ken. Thanks a lot. I do appreciate it. Thank you. Ken wants me to remain accurate, and I appreciate that, and I salute that. And in fact, the reason that this law, by the way, this law, the reason it was put into place in the first place was for companies that have vehicles. So if you have a dump truck or if you have a delivery car or whatever, they figured, this is a legitimate company vehicle that's not like the company car. It's like a delivery vehicle or something like that. And well, how do you know if it's actually the delivery vehicle, or how do you know if it's like, the car that the president of the company is using? And so back 20 years ago or so, they said, well, let's put a 6,000-pound weight limit. Anything over 6,000, because nobody was making cars that weighed over 6,000 pounds back then. And so they said, anything that weighs over 6,000 pounds, we'll consider that equipment. And if it's under 6,000 pounds, we'll consider it an automobile. And that's where the exemption came from. And then it became a loophole. And then the SUV manufacturers came into it. And I'm telling you, this whole thing is being driven by this. And you can take a tax deduction, as Ken said, up to now $100,000, which is some refer to as the Hummer deduction. David in Port St. Lucie on the line. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up, Dave?
Good. Listen, I agree with everything you say. And so do 99% of the people I talk to. But what I'm finding is that when they go to the polls, I mean, they have to vote these Republicans out. But when they go to the polls, they vote their party almost all the way down 100% of the time. And I know that for a fact. I ran the State House of Representatives last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I did real well. I mean, my district, which was terribly gerrymandered by the legislature, a few years back, is only 30% Democrat. I received 43% of the vote.
Wow, you ran as a Democrat in is that what state are you in? Is that Louisiana?
In Florida. I'm in South
Florida. Okay.
Florida. In West Palm Beach. And I received almost 43% of the vote, and the 30%, being a Democrat, I ran as a Democrat. I did real well, but I'll never win that seat unless I become a Republican. When I become a Republican and run with the same ideology I have now, people are going to listen.
Yeah.
And when you have states that gerrymander their districts, we have to put Republicans up. That's what the Republicans did.
David, let me suggest. I think on
I half agree with you. I want to see rational, positive people who actually embrace the old-fashioned Republican ideals taking back the Republican Party. But I think that the other thing is that increasingly people who think that they are Republicans, people who think, you know, who have kind of bought into this, I'm a conservative because they've been listening to Limbaugh or whatever, and now are suddenly realizing these guys are abusing power. Tom DeLay, look at what's going on. They're just out there for the corporations. They're not here for us. I have a feeling the Republican Party's days are limited. Yeah, I don't really know, David.
These people just vote Republican. They don't even read the newspaper.
You know, they said the same thing about the Democrats 20 years ago, David. They were saying the same thing, you know, or 30 years ago. You know, the Democrats control everything. And 60 years ago, you know, during FDR, things go around. The word gets out. David, I appreciate the call. Thanks for calling in. And particularly, thanks for running for public office. That's great. God bless you.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small...
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
In the good old USA, I'd just like to say, tomorrow's dreams are always coming true.
And isn't it a great country?
All the little boys and girls are counting on the old red, white, and blue.
And that's what we need to take back, is the old red, white, and blue. We need to take this country back as a place of opportunity for all of us, not just the big multinational oil companies, not just the giant corporations. For all of us, this is just so common sense, just so very, very simple. Yes, it's time for our Bush Green Watch alert. The BushGreenWatch.org folks, EPA proposal to weaken water quality spurs outrage. With a public comment period closing today, environmental groups are continuing to battle against the EPA's proposal to weaken Clean Water Act provisions. Now we have Republicans with this oil, you know, with the energy bill trying to weaken the Clean Air Act, the most radical weakening of it in 15 years. Now they also are, the EPA is trying to weaken the Clean Water Act protections for selenium, a toxic metal discharged into bodies of water by coal mines and coal-fired power plants. In Pennsylvania, a major coal mining state, local environmental groups are battling the proposed weakened standard. Arthur Stamoulis, spokesman for the Philadelphia-based Clean Air Council, told Bush Green Watch, quote, coal mines and coal-fired power plants in Pennsylvania already produce more selenium than in any other state. The new criteria would increase selenium discharge by 200% to 300%. Wow. They're going to double or triple the discharges of a toxin. While selenium exists naturally in a wide variety of habitats, and small amounts are crucial to the survival of humans and wildlife, high levels can cause severe reproductive impairment and even death in fish, birds, and other wildlife. In humans, selenium is linked to kidney and liver damage and damage to the circulatory and nervous systems. Joan Mulhern, senior legislative counsel at Earth Justice, says, quote, the Bush administration is proposing changes to the selenium standard that are being promoted by the coal mining and other industries that want to avoid taking steps to limit this serious form of water pollution, end quote. Studies on which EPA based its proposal is also a point of controversy. Dennis Lay, a scientist with the U.S. Forest Service, says this is flawed at the outset. Amazing. Another outrage from the Bush administration. It's like every day there's something. Well, I guess we never run out of stuff to talk about here anyway. This is the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
If it weren't for...
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And every time Limbaugh hears that music, he ups his meds. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live all across the nation, all across the world. Drop by our chat room and say hello. We have guests there, friends there, members there from at least two continents, very often three. I don't think we've ever had four continents at one time. We have had people from four continents in the chat room, but I'm not sure at one time. Anyhow, you can get there by going to TomHartman.com. It will drop you in there. John Bolton. John Bolton is, this story is just getting bigger and bigger. Here's the piece in the Washington Post today, a piece in the Daily Coast yesterday, actually on Friday. The piece in the Daily Coast was actually, a letter that was written by a woman who worked for a private corporation, Black Manafort Stone and Kelly, private corporation that was a contractor to the USAID, the Agency for International Development, which some say, oh, it's a CIA front group, whatever. It's one of our federal agencies that goes into third world countries and, like, you know, we're here to help and does projects. And it's also, you know, in some ways kind of one of these, well, we can use this to give a little money to our political friends, unfortunately. So here, this was in 94. Now, this was during the Clinton administration. I guess, you know, the Republican corruption of some of these agencies and institutions reaches so deep that, you know, even after Clinton had been in office for a couple of years, he hadn't had a chance to figure it out. This was in the summer of 94. Melody Townsend worked as a subcontract leader of a USAID project, USAID project in Kyrgyzstan. And that was officially awarded to a hub primary contractor. And she says, after months of incompetence, poor contract performance, inadequate in-country funding, and a general lack of interest or support in our work from the prime contractor, I was forced to make USAID officials aware of the prime contractor's poor performance. And so she flies from Kyrgyzstan to Moscow. She gets on a plane. These guys, they're screwing up. They're taking the government money and they're just screwing up. And so she gets on a plane. She goes to Moscow, which is where the headquarters for the AID office were for that region, and meets there with the officials and says, you know, this company is like screwing the government. You know, they're not doing a good job. They're stealing from us. They're taking. I mean, these are my words, not hers. They are. Well, her words, quote, incompetence, poor contract performance, inadequate in-country funding, and a general lack of interest or support in our work from the prime contractor. And so this company hires a lawyer to go after her. And this lawyer, within hours of the time that she sends a letter to USAID officials outlining this thing, this lawyer shows up. Well, as she says, and so within hours of dispatching that letter, my hell began. The lawyer that this contractor hired was none other than John Bolton. She says, and I'm quoting now from the letter of Melody Townsend, a letter that she wrote to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Mr. Bolton proceeded to chase me through the halls of a Russian hotel, throwing things at me, shoving threatening letters under my door, and generally behaving like a madman. For nearly 2 weeks, while I awaited fresh direction from my company and from USAID, John Bolton hounded me in such an appalling way that I eventually retreated to my hotel room and stayed there. Mr. Bolton, of course, then routinely visited me there to pound on the door and shout threats. She goes on to say, when USAID asked me to return to Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan, in advance of assuming leadership of a project in Kazakhstan, I returned to my project to find that John Bolton had preceded me by 2 days. Why? To meet with every other AID team leader as well as U.S. Foreign Service officials in Bishkek, claiming that I was under investigation for misuse of funds, she says, and likely was facing jail time.
As USAID can confirm, nothing was further from the truth. Gee, John Bolton lying? What a surprise. I mean, you know, you can trust his intelligence. He told us the truth about those weapons of mass destruction, didn't he? She says, when I resurfaced in Kyrgyzstan, I learned that he had done... Oh, I missed a piece in the middle here. He indicated to key employees of, or contractors to, the State Department that, based on his discussions with investigatory officials, I was headed for federal prison, she says, and if they refused to cooperate with either him or the prime contractor's replacement team leader, they, too, would find themselves the subjects of federal investigation. He's threatening people that she worked with federal investigations. She says, as a further aside, he made unconscionable comments about my weight, my wardrobe, and with a couple of team leaders, my sexuality, hinting that I was a lesbian. For the record, I'm not. And then she talks about when she resurfaced in Kyrgyzstan, she learned that he had done such a convincing job of smearing her that it took her weeks, with the direct intervention of USAID officials, to limit the damage. In fact, she says, it was only USAID's appointment of me as a project leader in Almaty, Kazakhstan, that largely put paid to the rumors Mr. Bolton maliciously circulated. She says, as a maligned whistleblower, I've learned firsthand the lengths Mr. Bolton will go to accomplish any goal he sets for himself. Truth flew out the window. Decency flew out the window. In his bid to smear me and promote the interests of his client, he went straight for the low road and stayed there. John Bolton, she says, put me through hell. Through hell. And he did everything he could, she says, to intimidate, malign, and threaten not just me, but anybody unwilling to go along with his version of events. She says his behavior back in 1994 wasn't just unforgivable, it was pathological. She says, I cannot believe that this man is being seriously considered for any diplomatic position, let alone such a critical posting to the UN. Others you may call before your committee will be able to speak better to his stated dislike for and objection to UN stated goals. I write to you to speak about the very character of the man. Well, you know, I have a feeling that this might actually help John Bolton. I'm serious. Here you have a woman saying that his behavior... His behavior is pathological, that he will go to any lengths to protect his client. Truth flies out the window. Decency flies out the window. So what? Is this starting to sound familiar? So what if a CIA operation gets shut down and destroyed? The lead counterterrorism operation in the United States. I'm speaking now, of course, of Joe Wilson and his wife, Valerie Plame. Joe Wilson outed George W. Bush. And Karl Rove, or Scooter Libby, or Dick Cheney, and I'm guessing that Dick Cheney is the guy responsible for this, and that's why Bob Novak is not in jail, and that's why the investigation is going nowhere. Somebody outed Valerie Plame and brought down an entire CIA counterterrorism operation, destroyed part of our intelligence system's ability to find terrorists and find terrorists who are trying to acquire weapons of mass destruction. I mean, this is not a small thing. And what does George W. Bush have to say about it?
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Yeah, I don't have any idea. See, everybody reading this, I'm telling you, progressives around the country, normal people around the country, the average American, they will read this and they'll go, oh my God. But the Bushies, they're going to read this and go, hey, this is our man. In fact, they probably already read this kind of thing from dozens of sources. I mean, you vet these people, come on, and said, this is the kind of person we want. The Bush administration? Ethics? Standards? Truth? Oh, come on. Get real, they're saying. It's not about that. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, if you'd like to be on the program. 16 minutes past the hour, Logan in New York City on the line. Hey, Logan, what's up?
Hey, what's up? I just wanted to actually pick up on what you were saying. You were right. Basically, the things that we think disqualify these nominees are basically the things that they think, the administration thinks, qualify them. And
yeah. That's the bigger picture here, is that this administration is a racketeering, influenced, corrupt organization.
Yeah, and the other point I just wanted to make is this whole attack on the judiciary is less about the Christian right than it is about getting judges that will interpret in their favor certain things like the Patriot Act and enemy combatant.
And will give, you know, light sentences, rule against anybody in this administration,
right,
who will rule, oh, he committed white-collar crime, he just ripped off a few million people, he just, you know, well, he can pay a fine, no problem. Why, he's caught smoking a joint, hey, 5 years in prison, that's it. And, no, that, yeah, that's, the I think that the judges thing, they're the last thing between these guys and absolute power.
Exactly.
That's the bottom line.
It has nothing to do with abortion.
No, ultimately it doesn't. And you look at the people that they're putting forward and the kind of behavior that they've engaged in the past. Priscilla Owen, for example, much of these toxic 10 nominees, much of what they are being accused of, or the reasons why the Republicans have been filibustering them, isn't because they've taken radical stands on, quote, moral issues, or, quote, whatever you want to call that stuff, you know, on religion or on sexuality. It's because they have taken radical issues with regard to corporate behavior, malfeasance of public officials, and they have been openly partisan, just totally in favor of the Reich side. And not, you know, they've been willing to allow their politics to affect their judicial decisions, and that's what these guys want.
They want partial.
Yeah, partial. What do you mean?
They want partial people. They don't want impartial.
Oh, I see what you mean. Oh, yeah, I was thinking partial as in a part. Yes, of course, you're absolutely right. They do. And that's the thing. Here we have had several recently, you know, from the religious right spokespeople to people in the House of Representatives and the Senate saying, "Aren't these judges? They're answerable to nobody. How dare they?" Well, they're supposed to be answerable to nobody. That's the democracy's last defense. The founders built it into the Constitution. If the president ever went nuts, if the House of Representatives and the Senate were ever taken over by one party. I mean, this was what they tried to stop. The Federalists back then. I mean, this is the defense. This is the democracy's last defense. Is this?
I hear you, Tom. Thanks for bringing this out.
You're welcome, Logan, and thanks for the call. It's great to hear from you, and thanks for listening to us there in New York City. I do appreciate it. This is why it's so important that we stop this. And now you got Bill Frist in here, and he's going to do the nuclear option. I'm telling you. And the main reason he's doing it, half the reason is the judges. The other half the reason will pop your eyeballs. I'll tell you right after this. 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Ah, yes. Welcome back. Hello, my friends.
Yes, me friend, me friend. Them set me free again.
24 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Our number 1-866, toll free across the United States, 1-866-889-8894. Here's the story. I just have to very quickly tell you this. I think this is a brilliant take on this. What Bill Frist is up to, he gets a benefit if he gets the nuclear option through. And he may not. Folks in the chat room are saying, hey, he doesn't have the votes for it. And I've certainly read that. I'm not sure. And I'm not sure that he's sure at this point yet. Does he have the votes for it or not? But he gets the benefit of having pushed it through. But the main thing is, this is Bill Frist taking on John McCain. That's what's really going on here. What's really going on here is who's going to be the top dog in the Senate and possibly the Republican presidential nominee in 2008. And John McCain is against the nuclear option, and Bill Frist is in favor of it.
And this is really about Bill Frist showing John McCain who's in charge, and Bill Frist getting, you know, getting more political power. I am absolutely convinced that that's just a huge chunk of this thing. Rick in Grand Rapids on the line in Michigan. Hey, Rick, what's your take on it?
Well, on that particular issue, I think you're leaving out Chuck Hagel. I think he might be a more attractive candidate than either Frist or McCain.
Yeah, and he's certainly been working on positioning himself for it over the last 2 years.
But on this Bolton thing, I've been following this, you know, and it does seem ironic. Of course, the Bushies always like to act tough, you know, the tough cowboy image. But, of course, this is a diplomatic post, and Mr. Bolton seems to not even think the United Nations should exist. So it seems almost like appointing somebody a surgeon general who doesn't believe in medicine, you know, like a Christian Scientist or something. But, you know, I just wonder which part of the Republican Party he's trying to appeal to here, because this is probably an oversimplification, but basically in the Republican Party, you got the Wall Street crowd, you got the Christian coalition types, and you've got the gun rights people. It's just unclear to me.
The gun rights people are, frankly, a very, very small subset. They're such a small subset of the Republican Party that I don't think that they're a big variable.
They can be a swing vote, though.
Well, in some areas they may be. I mean, interestingly, Bernie Sanders gets reelected over and over again, and the gun rights people are actually on his side. It's in Vermont, for example. I think that really the Republican Party breaks out along. There are the leftover libertarians, the pseudo-libertarian types, and the gun rights people fall into that category.
Sure.
But they're a part of a larger category. And they're the ones who agree with everything on the Libertarian Party take, you know, the Ayn Rand folks, except for the libertarians' notion of personal freedom and liberty. And the drug laws should be done away with,
sure.
Laws against prostitution should be done away with, stuff like that. So they're the pseudo-leftover libertarians. That's one branch, the no-government, small-government bunch. There is the, as you say, the Wall Street crowd. I call them the corporatists.
Sure.
And then there are the morals bunch, and they call themselves the Christians, but actually there are other religions in there as well, and there are people who are not at all religious in there, and I simply call them the paranoids. They're the people who think that the best way that you can control people's behavior is by scaring the living bejesus out of them, and so that they're constantly terrified, and these are people who are afraid of sexuality. They're afraid of basically freedom. They're control freaks. They're pathological control freaks.
You said they're afraid of sexuality, but they seem to be afraid of other people's sexuality, because every once in a while we find out that they're doing the same thing that they're condemning the so-called godless liberals for doing.
Yeah, that. Yeah, what a surprise. You know,
if you have sexual hang-ups yourself, that's fine, but why do you have to foist that on other people, you know?
Yeah, well, they're very, very competent at that. They're very, I mean, you look at all the guys, you know, Livingston and all these guys who were part of the the Lynch Bill Clinton crowd, you know, and they were all having affairs on the side. Newt Gingrich and Bob Barr and the whole bunch of them. I mean, you know, just at the same time, they're taking, you know, they're up there. Not that we need to, you know, revisit the Clinton years.
No, but
it's just incredible. Rick, we got to move along. But thanks for the call.
I
appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Telling the truth to multinational corporations we'd really rather you didn't know about. Truth and common sense in broadcasting.
A party at Ed's house. Okay. Will Ed's parents be there? Then the answer is no.
Making sure an adult's there.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's really all about power. It's really all about power. I mean, when you boil down the con agenda, it's ultimately always about either money or power. Even the sexual part of it is about power. These are very insecure, fearful people who are constantly in, you know, they're the first couple levels of Maslow's hierarchy of human needs, safety, security, the basic survival needs, are constantly challenged, whether they are or not. And they try to inflict that on the rest of us.
You get, you know, the right-wingers on the radio talking about, yeah, those liberals are going to... And, you know, trying to just scare us constantly. All right, they hate America. Yes, that's what's going on. Come on. I love this country. Every progressive, every liberal I know loves this country. It's a question of what kind of country do we want to live in? What kind of society do we want to have? I wrote a piece about this that is on commondreams.org today, by the way. It's the second article up, www.commondreams.org, about what kind of nation do we want to live in. It's specifically about the inheritance tax, the estate tax, the death tax, whatever you want to call it. And it raises the issue. What kind of country? Do we want to live in an oligarchy? Do we want to live in a nation where a handful of very rich families basically control the country? Is that the kind of nation that the founders fought and died to create? Do you really think so? I can tell you the Republicans in Congress certainly think so. The Bush family certainly thinks so. Many of the members of Congress come from those kinds of families, and those who don't are funded by them. The heirs of the robber barons. Look at the, you know, and the right-wing think tanks and the right-wing institutions from Reverend Moon's Washington Times, Reverend Moon creating his own personal dynasty out of his arms business. Invested over $1 billion now, still losing money, the Washington Times. Doesn't matter. Rupert Murdoch and Fox News, they just started making money. I have to believe that, you know, there's some ideology there, but probably that was, in Murdoch's mind, as much a business deal as anything else. Hey, there's these right-wing wackos out here. Let's cater to them with the New York Post and the faux news and all that sort of thing. But it's really ultimately about power. This is what it all boils down to. And this is what I am convinced that this is what what Frist is all about. And this is why, as I said, he's pushing this thing against McCain. In fact, recently, Bill Frist said that John McCain, and I quote, will have no presidential aspirations, will have no presidential hopes if he pursues this course, end quote. I'm sorry, it wasn't Bill Frist who said that. It was Manuel Miranda, a former Frist staffer who now chairs the National Coalition to End Judicial Filibusters. Frist's right-hand man in this area. You know, basically they're saying, this is going to take out McCain from the primaries, which would be, you know, the Bushies would love it. W would love it. Jeb would love it. Man, that McCain, he's too independent. He likes to think for himself, and he's a war hero. He actually showed up for the military. Can you imagine? I mean, the real military, you know, during Vietnam, he actually showed up to go over there for a real war. No good Republican would do that, correct? You know, I shouldn't paint with all Republicans with that brush, because there are some very decent Republicans out there. I can't say that I know any of them personally. I used to. Jim Jeffords, who I voted for when I lived in Vermont, I thought he was a decent Republican. Or a decent man. And the Republican Party went so far to the right, he said, I can't have anything to do with these people anymore. They've gone nuts. They've gone nuts. Last week, reports the Center for American Progress, Senator Fritz's office announced that he would be speaking at an April 24 Family Research Council rally, whose organizers brazenly claim that opponents of Bush's judicial nominees are against people of faith. Say what? Against people of faith. The group's president, Tony Perkins, has gone even farther. He says, for years, activist courts have been quietly working under the veil of the judiciary like thieves in the night to rob us of our Christian heritage and our religious freedoms. Yeah. And then Chuck Hagel told CNN, when we talk religion and government, neither should be an instrument for the other. And I see drifting here in different directions that are, I don't think, healthy for our country. Say what? Chuck Hagel? Disagreeing with Bill Frist? Lindsey Graham, this is a dangerous precedent, disagreeing with Bill Frist. Trent Lott, saying if judicial nominees feel strongly and live and support the positions that reflect their faith, then they're disqualified. Oh, he says under the current system. Yes.
I mean, these guys, they're trying to tie these right-wing crank judicial nominees to the civil rights movement. You know, well, anyhow, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, and, oh, hey, Victoria Jones with our report from Washington, D.C., Talk Radio News Service on the line. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, yes, it is a very, very strange time in American politics, and listening to you just now, I was reminded just how very, very strange it is when you string all those together. It's just, this is a very peculiar town to be living in.
Yeah, yeah.
Very, very odd.
No doubt about it.
Then, meantime, back with the nomination of John Bolton to be our U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. I suggested last week that if very much more came out about this man, that he would not make it.
Mm-hmm.
And more is coming out about this.
Oh, I've been reading this letter that this woman wrote saying that he chased her down the halls of a hotel in Moscow. And now we've got the Washington Post article about how he was not giving information to Colin Powell and Condi Rice. And I've been saying for some time that Condi Rice, basically, she said, I don't want him. And Bush said, well, he's, you know, we're going to reward him because he's been a good soldier. And so let's put him in the U.N. But, you know, the other point is that I think that this behavior of his, rather than disqualifying him for the job in the minds of the Bushies, if it just didn't become public, actually is what qualified him for the job in the first place.
I think that's quite possible in the minds of the Bushies. In the minds, though, of the politicos and the people having these hearings. I mean, Chuck Hagel, who you were just talking about, even yesterday, he indicated that at this point, that was yesterday, he'd probably still vote for him, but if much more came out, you know, he'd have to start reconsidering it. And I think that's probably what is going to happen. I mean, the chasing this woman down the hotel corridor story is quite extraordinary. And for the listeners who don't know, there was nothing amorous about this.
No, he was threatening her.
Right.
And then she hides in her hotel room, and he comes and bangs on her door and screams at her and slides threatening letters under the door. But see, he's doing it as the lawyer for a corporation that she has pointed out is ripping off the government. And you know, corporations ripping off the government, that's the Bush way of life.
And so he was fulfilling his duty.
That's right.
As a member of the private sector at that time.
There you go. He was doing the thing that good Republicans do, or good conservative, whatever these people call themselves. We have to come up with a new word for them. Good fascists do, or something. I don't know.
That's an option.
Yeah. do you think you're back to? I mean, we had. As I recall, kind of, I don't recall if it was a conversation I had with you or with Ellen. It was with you, yeah. We have sort of a little bet on this here. You think he's going to go down?
I do. I think he's going to go down. I really do.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. So where are they going to find another, toady?
Well, I think quite honestly, almost anywhere, because I think what they'll go for next, I think they will go for somebody who is conservative, who wants reform at the U.N., and who may be quite outspoken, but who is not out of control. And if they go for someone like that, the Democrats will certainly confirm that person. They'll have no problem confirming someone who wants to reform at the U.N. I mean, because they certainly can't schnooker two people in a row.
Yeah.
And they don't.
Well, I wouldn't depend on that. I wouldn't depend on that, Victoria.
If it's a total nutcase, then yes, I imagine they will. Yeah. Yes. So that's the key. I mean, don't put forward nutcases.
But see, for example, they put forward as our attorney general a lawyer who said international law doesn't matter, U.S. law doesn't matter, the president is above the law, we can create a whole new category of human beings called enemy combatants who aren't covered under the rules of war on the one hand and aren't covered under civil law on the other, and they're covered under nothing. This guy, I mean, talk about nutcases, and this guy's our attorney general now. That you have a woman who's got an oil tanker named after her, who engineered the greatest, or who oversaw the greatest intelligence failure in the history of the United States as the senior intelligence advisor to security advisor to the president, and she's now the Secretary of State. I mean, it's Victoria.
I know. And I could be totally wrong. It could be that this guy's going to get through, but I just have a feeling about this.
Yeah,
one.
Well, no, what I'm saying is if he goes down, and you may well be right. I mean, it may be that the gag factor is too high, or it may be that the factions within the Republican Party that are starting to emerge, you know, the McCain faction who wants to take on the Frist faction over the nuclear option, for example, these factions that are starting to emerge out of the Republican Party of the old line Republicans who really believe in what the Republican Party once stood for versus these folks, these con men. Yeah, if I call them fascists, people say you're overstating. If I call them conservatives, then I have conservatives call a program and say that these guys aren't conservatives, they're radicals. If I call them radicals, then I get, you know, radical progressives calling them saying don't use that. It's, what do you call them?
I think corrupt. Folks.
Yeah, well.
It can become a buzzword.
Yeah,
you know?
It's not sufficiently descriptive, I think. What else is happening in Washington, by the way?
Well, not very much. The president is out of town.
Where?
I wish you hadn't asked me that, because if you hadn't asked me, I could have told you.
Oh, today, just scared it out of you.
It's one of those, I want to say Ohio, but that's just because I tend to think that he's always in Ohio.
Is he on his Social Security roadshow?
Well, basically, the way the Social Security roadshow seems to be going, wherever he goes now, he puts it in there, whether it was going to be in there or not. So right. Almost every trip is a Social Security roadshow. As we do see, a very frustrating session with Scott McClellan, the White House press secretary, last week, in which he was being asked questions about the Social Security roadshow, and would not concede, although the language has changed somewhat, that this just isn't going to fly. And he kept talking about education, educating the American people. And that, so the line seems to be that this is an education of the American people process. And the idea that any kind of legislation was expected to come out of this seems to have gone away. It's just, yeah. You know, we're just teaching now.
Well, you know, yesterday's Washington Post had an interesting article by Jim Vandehill, in which he said, he wrote that now it's in the hands of Charles Grassley, the Republican from Iowa. Basically, mm-hmm. The president is, Bush is confident he has convinced Americans that Social Security faces long-term fiscal problems. And now he wants the Finance Committee, which has jurisdiction over the issue, to take the lead role in crafting a new Social Security program. See, somebody is going to have to say, you know, Bush's private accounts don't do anything for the fact that Social Security at some point down the road, 40 years down the road, is going to be taking in less money than it's spending. They don't do anything for that. They do nothing for that. And so we either have to increase Social Security taxes and build up the trust fund a little bigger, or we have to cut benefits. We have to do one or the two or both. And Bush has absolutely avoided even talking about this, other than to say everything's on the table, which is, you know, kind of a generality. But he won't even speak these words, and so he hands this off to Grassley, and now Grassley's going to have to deal with it. And he's going to start holding hearings, and this I suspect could be the undoing of the whole thing, because now it's going to start getting real.
Yeah.
You think?
I do think.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
No, I think you're absolutely right.
And so, you know, what I'm seeing is George W. Bush has never in his entire life taken responsibility for anything. Nothing. And he's never been wrong. In fact, I suspect that he was raised in the kind of environment where he was severely punished if he was wrong or when he was wrong, that, you know, this whole punishment mentality is so deeply entrenched in him that he can gleefully execute 136 people and just feel just fine about it, you know, and that so he can't take responsibility for it. And it looks like it's going down. It looks like, you know, this ship is starting to tilt to starboard and in a way that's not healthy. And so he's going to hand it off to the Senate and say, OK, you guys, you take it. And the senators on the Finance Committee have to be scared to death.
I would think so. Absolutely.
They've got to be terrified. Do you know any of these guys?
Not personally, not well. I mean, just to say hello in the hall. And at this point, nobody would admit to that kind of terror.
Yeah,
everyone's still putting a good face on things.
That has to be the question. I mean, that has to be the question. I would love to get a list of the senators on the Finance Committee and just, you know, call them or contact them, or if you could, you know, if you have any opportunity to do so, and just say, okay, you're going to be the ones now who, in front of the American public, are going to be discussing
whether or not we're going to cut Social Security benefits or raise Social Security taxes, because there really are no other options. Or, well, actually, the third option is, or whether we're going to borrow more money from our grandchildren out of the main.
That's the easy option. That's the route.
Well, that's what they've been, that's what they've done in everything else. But I think it's reaching the point where even the Republicans are realizing that Bush has borrowed us into such a deep hole now that not only are we the laughingstock of the world, but we're quickly becoming the laughingstock of the financial world. And when they stop laughing, they're going to start pulling their money out. And when they pull their money out, we're going to be flipped into something that's going to make 1932, 1933 look like, gee, those were the good old days.
You start cleaning off those window ledges.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah. Anyhow, if you can track down any of those folks or find out, you know, what's happening, because I think this is where the action's going to be on the finance committee, and I'd love to hear back on that. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, thanks so much for calling in today, Victoria.
Bye bye.
We will talk with you tomorrow. Have a great one. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. You're in the middle of the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no annotations.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brush Show, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com. You're listening to Tom Hartman because you're intelligent, progressive, and like the thousands of...
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Had another dream about a lion.
And welcome back. The pill that will help you escape the matrix, the no boring zone, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 5 minutes before the hour. Today marks the 70th anniversary. The 70th, 70 years ago today, was the first Republican attack on Social Security. April 18th, 1935. 70 years ago today, Senator Allen Towner Treadway, Republican of Massachusetts, became the first Republican to attempt to kill Social Security. He had introduced an amendment to the Social Security Act that would have killed the old age benefits provision of the Democratic Social Security Act. While debating the bill, Treadway vowed to oppose Social Security at, quote, every opportunity, end quote. A commitment that continues with today's Republican Party. This actually, the Democrats put this out. This is a news release from, we got this from Candy Stroud. She's, you know, DNC spokesperson. This is so cool. The Democrats are finally getting their act together. I just don't get these things all that often. I get all kinds of them from the Republicans. Talking points for talk show hosts, whatever, but this is cool, this is good, and it's good information. Treadway attempted to kill Social Security before it was law. On April 11, 1935, debate began in the U.S. House of Representatives on the Social Security Act, House Resolution 7260. On April 18th, that's today, 70 years ago today, Allen Towner Treadway, Republican from Massachusetts, offered an amendment to strike the sections of the law that created the old age benefits provision, Article 2 of the revenue system. Treadway was the ranking Republican on the Influential Ways and Means Committee at the time. His amendment was defeated in a 49-125 vote. Treadway and other Republicans vowed to oppose Social Security at every opportunity. During debate on the Treadway amendment, Mr. Jenkins, the Republican from Ohio, a supporter of Treadway, called the Social Security program compulsion of the rankest kind. How dare they take taxes away from us and give them to old poor people? We can't have that going on any longer. During the debate on the bill, Treadway vowed to vote most strenuously in opposition to the bill at each and every opportunity. Well, 70 years later, they're still at it. To quote Grover Norquist, Social Security is a lousy program. Yeah. Yeah, tell that to people getting Social Security. Or who may be concerned about the future. It is the basis of our social safety net. And thank God for Franklin Roosevelt and the Democrats who brought it to us. I'm Tom Hartman. Talk radio for the rest of us.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace?
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, they say in the Bush administration, if you don't like the news, kill the messenger. In fact, kill the message. Get rid of the whole thing. If you don't like the news, throw it. If you don't like the news, don't have the news. It's a nice plan. The American people don't need to know everything. Congress doesn't need to know everything. Our intelligence agencies don't need to. After all, it worked with the Iraq War. It's working right now with, doesn't seem like there's anybody dying in Iraq. I'm certainly not seeing any photos of coffins or grieving families on the news. Yeah, it seems to be working just fine. And now we've got this international terrorism report. For almost 20 years, 19 years, they have been producing this. This is how long we have had terrorism on the radar screen as something, you know, to be a significant concern. The International Terrorism Report, and the State Department decided to stop publishing the report. Every year, basically, the State Department goes through and they say, okay, how many terrorist incidents were there around the world? I mean, you know, the State Department's job to keep track of the world, right? The State Department runs the diplomats, it runs the embassies. They get the information from the different embassies. They get the information from the intelligence agencies. They put all this stuff together, and they say, okay, what was the situation with regard to international terrorism? Has it gotten better or worse? You know, what are the trends? How are things going? And then they publish this report. Put it together. Print it up. Send it out. And now, no, we're not going to do that anymore. As Jonathan Landy in the Knight Ritter newspapers notes, the State Department decided to stop publishing an annual report on international terrorism after the government's top terrorism center concluded that there were more terrorist attacks in 2004 than in any year since 1985, the first year the publication covered. In other words, more than ever in history. Unless you want to go back to the Revolutionary War or the Civil War and call the Confederates or the Redcoats, you know, the people who were fighting against what ultimately was the United States of America, although many people in the South would bristle at that characterization of the Confederates, and I'm not making it, I'm just saying if you were to call those terrorist incidents, I mean, you say, well, okay, we had prime time, because the British certainly said that we were terrorists. I mean, this was the British, the biggest objection. We were not respecting the norms of war. We did not fight a standard war against the British. We hid behind trees to shoot at them. You can't hide behind trees to shoot at us? That's wrong! You're supposed to line up in a line, and when the general says, fire, then you shoot! How dare those Minutemen! Well, in any case, that was terrorism then. This is terrorism now. 19 years we've been publishing this thing. And why did they stop? Well, they said the methodology of the National Counterterrorism Center is faulty, and, you know, it's just, it's not working out the way we want. It's just, you know, the American people, they don't really need to know, is terrorism getting better or worse? After all, everybody knows George Bush is winning the war on terror. Yes, indeed, that he was elected to do that, and he's doing that, right? Well, no. Well, he couldn't be making things any worse. Well, yeah, he is making things worse. In fact, he's making things a lot worse. In fact, last year was the worst year for terrorism in the history
of the counterterrorism report and perhaps in the history of the United States. Again, as I said, unless you count the, you know, a couple of wars that were fought on American soil. And I don't think you should, frankly. So here we had in 2003, which was the highest number in 20 years, 175 terrorist incidents around the world. And George W. Bush decides that year that he's going to attack Iraq, a largely defenseless country. We took them out in, what, 3-4 days? I mean, you know, no air force. We had bombed their air force into smithereens. We had had weapons inspectors in there for a decade. And then, you know, they were out for a while, and then they were back in there for months, and they'd gone around and looked for everywhere for everything. They were even showing up at Saddam's palaces unannounced. Hey, we're here. We're going to look under your bed. And Saddam was like, oh, you know, cool. There's nothing here. And we were saying, hey, prove to us that you destroyed those weapons of mass destruction. He provides us with 14,000 pages of documentation. The Bushies have to go through and take out 5,000 pages before they give 9,000 left over to the UN. Why? Well, they still won't tell us. But it could be that those 5,000 pages have to do with Bush administration officials back during the Reagan and previous Bush administration, you know, like Rummy and Dickie Cheney, and selling weapons of mass destruction to Saddam, and then those were the things that Saddam destroyed. And he might have just kind of pointed out where he got them from. He was, after all, our ally, you'll remember. Well, anyhow, 175 incidents in 2003, and then Bush has his war, and Mubarak, Hosni Mubarak, president of Egypt, he says, if you do this, if you invade Iraq like this, you're going to create 100. It was 100, wasn't it? Or did he say 1,000? My recollection is he said you're going to create 100. Maybe he said you're going to create 1,000 Osama bin Ladens. And sure enough, I mean, we have these new terror leaders, one in the Philippines and one in Southeast Asia. There's a group now in Pakistan. We've got, you know, this guy in Iraq. You know, he's our second most wanted. Mubarak says you're going to have more terrorism if you do this. And he kind of like lives in the neighborhood. He knows it. He's familiar with it. He understands it. You're going to have more terrorism if you do this. 175 incidents in 2003. 2004, it jumped to 625, quote, significant, end quote, terrorist attacks, 2004. Tripled. More than tripled. The Bush administration's response? Don't publish those numbers anymore. Please don't publish those numbers anymore. And then there's a couple of folks inside the Bush administration who, you know, kind of share the rationale, the thinking behind this, and they're scared to death. Because what Bolton did with that woman in Kyrgyzstan, chasing her down the hotel room, throwing things at her, threatening her, pounding on her door, telling her coworkers that she was a lesbian and that she was under, that she was being investigated by federal authorities, that she could go to federal prison, that they could too if they stood up for her, and none of it was true. Bolton trying to destroy a person because she dared stand up. Dared stand up to the Republican that she was reporting to. And she didn't even think of it as standing up. She thought that she was simply pointing out that the government of we, the people of the United States of America, was being ripped off. You get it, ripped off. That's all, you know, she's... And Bolton, who is the lawyer for the company that was doing the ripping off of the government, goes ballistic, goes insane, well, goes pathological. To quote this accusation that surfaced over the weekend. Well, the people within the administration who want to tell the truth are frightened by this kind of thing. They see what happened to people who dared speak out. You know, look at what happened to Valerie Plame's, you know, Joe Wilson's wife. Look at what happened to John O'Neill.
Oh, John O'Neill, excuse me. John O'Neill, well, look at what happened to him, too. I mean, that's a terrible disaster. Here was the guy who was in counterterrorism, was very upset, worried about bin Laden, leaves the government, gets transferred to being head of security in the private sector. He thinks he's got a nice, safe private sector job. First week on the job as head of director of security at the World Trade Center. I meant Paul O'Neill, though, when I first said it, the former Treasury Secretary. He dares speak out against the administration. He's nuts. He's eccentric. He's got his own agenda. He's trying to sell a book. And, you know, and on it goes. Richard Clark. We're running around with our hair on fire. Oh, yeah, he's a little nutty. Don't pay attention. They're constantly having to say, don't look at that man behind the curtain. I mean, that's what it boils down to. Just keep watching the wizard. Don't look at that man behind the curtain. So here at Night Runner Newspapers, Jonathan Landay writes, the statistics didn't include attacks on American troops in Iraq. By the way, the 625 significant terrorist attacks in 2004 did not include the terrorist attacks on us in Iraq. Because that would be thousands. Previous year, 2003, the worst year in history, 175. Last year, 624. Terrorism is going off the scale as the result of the Bush Doctrine and the Bush policies. Well, how did these numbers get out if Condi decided that she wasn't going to release the report and they weren't going to publish the report anymore? How did it get out? To quote Knight Ridder Newspapers, the intelligence officials, these are the ones who leaked this to the media, requested anonymity because the information is classified and because they said they feared White House retribution. And guess what, friends? That is a legitimate fear. That is a very legitimate fear. They feared White House retribution. Absolutely incredible. Moving on, as it were, I want to talk about, we've talked a lot about outsourcing on this program and American jobs going overseas. What about people coming into the United States? And we have basically two categories of aliens coming into the United States to do labor in the United States. And one is very much on the radar screen, and that's illegal aliens. We know that there's somewhere between 7 and 10 million. Well, actually, nobody's really sure. In fact, I've heard Lou Dobbs, I believe, quote numbers as high as 20 million illegal aliens in the United States. We know that roughly 10% of the population of Mexico is living in the United States illegally and working. And now you have the cons trying to put, you know, lipstick on this pig and saying, well, you know, they are paying Social Security taxes and they're not getting Social Security because they don't have legal Social Security numbers. And it did make up 10% of the surplus. Well, the surplus wasn't that great, so it's like 10. But they kind of try to word it like it was 10% of all Social Security money or something, like it's some big deal. It's not. Because these are very low-wage jobs. And they're not making that much money. But there's a lot of them. And they're driving wages down. But what about the legal immigrant? Not immigrants. What about the legal folks, the folks who are working legally on visas in the United States? This will shock you right after this, 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman radio program. The Fristalog. You know, the Decalog is the Ten Commandments. Well, here's the Deca, as in, you know, Latin for ten. Decalog, Ten Commandments. Here's the Fristalog. Number one, the first commandment, thou shalt not filibuster. Number two, thou shalt not be allowed, this is from uggabugga.blogspot.com, by the way. Number two, thou shalt not be allowed to make decisions for an incapacitated spouse. Maybe they should add to that, and doctors shall be allowed to diagnose people by video tape recorder. Number three, thou shalt not honor judicial rulings. Number four, thou shalt not file a class action suit. Number five, thou shalt not guarantee a secure retirement for the elderly. Commandment number six, the sixth commandment, thou shalt not fund scientific research. The seventh commandment, thou shalt not care for veterans. The eighth commandment, thou shalt not be fully compensated for asbestos-related illness. That was the eighth commandment, The ninth commandment, thou shalt not be allowed to declare bankruptcy. And the tenth commandment, thou shalt not tax the richest of the rich. Kind of boils it down, doesn't it? It's remarkable. You know, you just kind of see it in all, see it in one place there, and yeah, it just boils right down. I want to get back to these visas, and then also I want to share with you this story, which we will get to in a few minutes, about how one of the leading causes of death in women is preventable, but the conservatives don't want to prevent it. We'll come back to that. But here, true stories concerning non-immigrant visas and H-1B related issues. This is from a website called HireAmericanCitizens.org. And it's their Amazing Facts page. And it is truly amazing facts. And we've verified a few of these, and they're right there. Now, first of all, let me just give you a little background on this. We have had a program in the United States for years and years that allows employers to hire aliens, to hire people from outside the United States, but only if you can't find an American who can do that job. And I can tell you, it used to be really enforced that way. I was running an advertising agency in Atlanta, Georgia, back 12, 13 years ago, and, whatever year that was, anyhow. And we were publishing a newsletter. It was called the Newsletter Factory. It still is. I mean, it's still there. And we were publishing a newsletter for a company, one of our clients, that was a multinational company that was headquartered in Atlanta, and they wanted their newsletter done in Japanese because they had a division there. They wanted it done in Spanish because they had several divisions down in South America, and they wanted it done in English. And we needed to find somebody who could translate text and do graphic design in Spanish, English, and Japanese. I'm not making this up. This is a real story. And we called around, we tried to find, we advertised, and this guy, his first name was Shinji, we called him. I'm not going to put his last name on the air, but anyhow, Shin was his first name, and his parents were Japanese. They had emigrated to Peru when he was, either before he was born or when he was very young, and he grew up in Peru speaking Spanish and Japanese, came to the United States when he was around 10 or 11 years old, and he learned a lot of English in Peru as well. I mean, you just do. They lived in Lima, the big city there, and I've been there. And big cities in South America, a lot of people speak English. It's, you know, it's sort of a second language, sort of like the big cities in America. I had to jump through so many hoops to hire this guy. I had to prove to the INS that we really needed him, that only, you know, only this one guy, because he wasn't a U.S. citizen. It took us 6 months to get him in. And you know, he could only work for us as long as we had that newsletter. Well, things have changed considerably since the Republicans took over. I'll tell you about it right after this. 29 minutes past the hour.
Now for a traffic update, we go to Kelly Clark. Kelly, how's it looking out there?
Well, if you've got to get anywhere, I hope you have lots of time. Uh-oh. All northbound lanes at the Taylor Interchange are backed up. Westbound lanes are at a standstill.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I'm just trying to go along with the music, you know, so this is at least 4 million H-1B visas were certified by the INS. This is the when we're looking at these visas, and I forget what the category of visa was that we had to get for Shinji, but my recollection is that it was an H-1B visa, but it could have been something else. As I say, this is 10, 12 years ago, and we had to notarize this thing. I had to swear an oath that I couldn't find a qualified American citizen who spoke Japanese, spoke English, and who had a degree in graphic arts. And I couldn't. And Shinji did. I mean, it was just this incredible coincidence that this guy was looking for a job and we had this need. But I can tell you, I've had the experience of doing this thing with the INS, of getting a visa for one of these foreign employees. Well, it's all changed. Now, under the Bushies, it has all changed. And maybe it changed under Clinton. I don't know. I don't know, frankly, when this change began. But I can tell you, it wasn't this way when the last time that I was running a company, which was a little more than a decade ago. Because at that time, boy, did we have to, I mean, we were sweating bullets if we could hire this guy, and because we had a client that meant a fair amount of money to our company. If we could get this client, if we could get this job and keep this job, and the only way we could get and keep that job was to hire this guy, Shinji, because he could produce a newsletter in Japanese, Spanish, and English. We actually had to proofread his English, but, you know, his Japanese and Spanish. We could send it out for proofreading. We could find people who Americans who read Japanese, and we could find Americans who read Spanish who could proofread the thing. But they couldn't lay it out. They couldn't do the design work. They didn't know how to use Quark, which was the design program that we were using at the time and all that kind of stuff. So anyhow, we went through all this difficulty. Well, now I'm looking at these statistics, and I'm just boggled. Between 1998 and 2001... So this is the tail end of the Clinton years. At least 4 million H-1B visas were certified by the INS. 4 million. I can't believe there were 4 million companies that literally could not find an American to do that job, whatever that job may have been. I mean, I've been running businesses on and off for 30 years. And only once in all that time have I ever had to look for somebody who had such a unique skill set that I couldn't find an American citizen to do it. Only once. But now you have a bunch of folks who are like building houses or who are, doing whatever. And they're saying, software design, building computer, fill in the blanks. And they're saying, well, we can't find an American engineer. We can't find the plot thickens here. Let me just share some of this. Many H-1B workers are paid minimum wage as their official salary, and the rest of their salary is paid as U.S. living expenses that are non-taxable. That's sweet. L1 workers, this is another category of visa, are considered employees of a foreign company. So you've got foreign companies inside the United States, and there are many of them. Perhaps as many as 5% of all employers in the United States, and I suspect that the number is actually much higher than that when you look at really what's going on. For example, the company that publishes several of my books, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight and What Would Jefferson Do, Random House, which is owned by Bertelsmann, which is a German company. So if Bertelsmann, I don't want to use them as an example because I frankly don't know what their business practices are. But if a company that has an American subsidiary decides to send a worker over from their home country, then they can become they get an L1 visa. Okay, we're just bringing somebody over here from the home country, and they don't have to pay any U.S. taxes because they're a citizen of that foreign country, and they actually are paid by the foreign company. So they get a paycheck in the United States, but it comes in the mail from, Germany or France or Italy or Japan or China or wherever. Or maybe the U.S. company pays them, however, they pay no U.S. taxes at all. Students from India are given an exemption from paying taxes. Figure that one out. IRS Circular E, Employer's Tax Guide, page 14.
At least 800,000 highly skilled U.S. workers are now unemployed as a direct result of the H-1B visa legislation, which failed to include protection for U.S. workers. This is reporting in 2001. One in five American workers lost a job during the last 3 years. This is from HireAmericanCitizens.org, their amazing facts page. One in five American workers lost a job during the last 3 years. Two-thirds of workers received less than 2 weeks' notice and no severance pay. Three-fourths did not maintain any health benefits. 35% of these workers are now underemployed. See, this is, you know, conservative economics, Republican economics. How to build and grow an economy. Yes, they really know how to do it. They brought us the Great Depression. They brought us the robber baron era. And now they're bringing us whatever we're going to call this thing. They brought us stagflation in the Bush and Carter administrations, where they were, you know, it was the consequence of Reaganomics. Reaganomics produced stagflation, inflation, and stagnant economy. It hurt Jimmy Carter terribly. And Reaganomics, we've had 5 years of it now, since, you know, George Bush, and it's going to catch up. We are going back into stagflation. I predict it. Paul Krugman wrote about it today in the New York Times, in fact, suggesting it's coming, folks. I'd say it's already here. In any case, the back to the statistics, since 1985, over 17 million visas have been issued to allow aliens to work in the United States and glut the labor market, says HireAmericanCitizens.org. These non-immigrant visas, or NIV, are company-sponsored visas that use a variety of names. These are not immigrants. They're temporary workers. Okay? These are not people who are trying, you know, they're aspiring to citizenship. They're simply cheap labor. It's just cheap labor for the corporate mill. 17 million of these things, non-immigrant visas or NIV, company-sponsored visas, use a variety of different names, H-1B, H-2A, H-2B, J-1, L-1, TN. Employers hire foreign workers even when qualified and equally qualified Americans are available and lay off Americans while retaining H-1Bs in the same job category, even though the H-1B program was created solely to fill a labor shortage of jobs that could not be filled by American workers. And I'm telling you, 15 years ago, actually, it worked that way. Because, as I said, I ran into it head on. Here's a quote. Siemens management mandated Americans to train their foreign replacement workers in Lake Mary, Florida. After training, the Americans were laid off while the foreigners live and work in Lake Mary, Florida. Senator Hillary Clinton, in 2003, cut the tape for the new Tata Consulting Buffalo office. Tata Consulting is the largest importer of cheap foreign H-1B workers. They are currently under investigation for immigration fraud. As Tom Tancredo, the Republican congressman from Colorado, said on the House floor, June 18, 2003, and this is where it gets scary, when those of us on the left start agreeing with Republicans, because it's not about right or left. It's not about Democrat or Republican. It's not about liberal or conservative. It's about America. It's about what kind of nation, what kind of society do you want to live in? Tom Tancredo said, and I quote, "When my colleagues get a letter from a constituent who has been displaced by foreign workers, they should write back to them and say, quote, it is the policy of this government to displace you, to move you into a lower economic income category, because we believe in cheap labor and we believe in the politics of open borders helps our party," end quote. And it does help the Republican Party. When I said this is where we have to get a little nervous when we're agreeing with Republicans, I didn't mean the entire Republican Party, this particular Republican. Because here's Tom Tancredo pointing it out, that the Republican Party believes that the politics of open border helps their party. How could it possibly help the Republican Party for there to be more unemployed Americans? Well, because they're corporatists. Very simple. This isn't rocket science. The Republican Party has become the party of, by, and for large multinational corporations. They know where the money is. They brought this thing about. Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, which led to the destruction of most small businesses in America. Millions of small businesses in America put out of business. tens of millions. Back in the 1960s, when I was a teenager, I hitchhiked across the United States. Well, from Michigan to California and back. And across much of the United States. Actually, from San Antonio to California, and then from California back to Michigan. And every little town that I went through, and this would have been, you know, 1967, 68, something like that. Every town that I went through was different. Every little town had, you know, there was Mom's Cafe and Sarah's Diner and the Dew Drop Inn Hotel and the you know, Drop By Motel and the at the most you would see, you know, McDonald's from time to time repeat themselves, or Woolworths. But pretty much every town had its own unique character. They had their own restaurants, they had their own retail stores, they had their own hardware stores, they had their own... All of that is gone. All of that is gone. And anybody who was born after, I would say, probably 1960, 1965, who came of age in the 80s... during Reagan, or came of age in the 90s, anybody who was born certainly after 1970 probably doesn't know this. Doesn't know that America used to be a country that was incredibly diverse, where in every little town in America, and every big town for that matter, every city block was filled with local family-owned businesses. Where have they all gone? Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act, Antitrust Act. We saw what they call this M&A mania. Remember M&A mania? Mergers and acquisitions mania. Just big companies getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. The big fish eating the medium-sized fish, eating the little fish, eating the little fish, eating the medium, and eating each other until there's nothing left but a few big fish. So now we have a situation where about 90% of all the media that we see, the magazines we read, the newspapers we read, the television we watch, the radio we listen to, is in the hands of a dozen or 15 companies, 12 to 15 companies. Where our cars are made by, you know, four or five companies. Where our it's just everything is just boiled down. You know, all of our, some 70-80% of our food is processed and handled by four or five companies. We are rapidly moving into oligarchy. Only instead of the wealthy families running the company, running the country, it's the wealthy companies running the country. Or controlling it, certainly. From 1925 to 1965, immigration averaged 178,000 people a year. Now we're taking in approximately 1.1 million legal immigrants every year. Homelessness has now risen above the levels seen during the Great Depression, that as of July 2003. At least 9 million Americans are unemployed. At least 17 million skilled, educated Americans are now unemployed in low-wage jobs, many part-time without benefits. By the end of January 2003, more than 70% of laid-off technology workers had exhausted their unemployment benefits, used them all up. Unemployment for technology workers has continued to rise. At the same time, the high-tech industry is importing these folks. The total number of U.S. technical jobs, around 8.5 million. We've imported around 3 to 4 million temporary foreign technical workers. We have 8.5 million U.S. technical jobs. And half of those are filled by temporary foreign workers. Why? Because they'll work for less. They'll work for $15,000, $20,000 a year instead of the $40,000 or $50,000 that a U.S. citizen, a graduate of college would expect as a computer engineer. In the year 2001, 9 out of every 10 new job openings for computer IT were taken by H-1Bs. 9 out of 10. And despite record unemployment, the INS issued 312,000 visas in 2002. Missouri residents who call an 1-800 number with questions about welfare, food stamps, and benefits, they're being routed to a call center in India now. 66%, two-thirds of Americans say their biggest worry today is whether or not they will have a job tomorrow. It goes on and on and on. I mean, there's just page after page after page of this. It's the bottom line. We are no longer, you know, what's best for America. Now it is
what's best for the big corporations. And how do they get away with this? They get away with this by pulling together a coalition of the corporatists, the leftover libertarians who somehow believe that if you just get government out of the way, then everything will be fine, and are, for them, invisible is the word to describe things like police departments, fire departments, road departments, public rights of way, public parks, the inspection of our foods, and safe drugs, all of that stuff. You know, they don't realize. I mean, they just don't get it. That's what government does. That's what your taxes pay for. It makes life livable in this country. You wouldn't want to live in this nation without those things. So anyhow, you have the leftover libertarians, and you've got the paranoid moralists. The paranoid moralists. And now the paranoid moralists are jumping back on the bandwagon, and they're and you know, this is an uneasy truce, but they all kind of bring each other together, and they're saying deaths from cervical cancer could jump fourfold to 1 million a year by 2050, mainly in developing countries. It could be prevented with a vaccine, but they don't want, they want to make sure that here in the United States, that vaccine is not available to teenage and preteen girls. And it could immunize them for life against death from cervical cancer. Oh no, we can't have that. Why? I'll tell you right after this. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. With the continuing erosion of the middle class and the separation between the rich and poor increasing at an alarming rate,
fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I ain't lived forever, but I've lived enough.
Yeah, me too.
I've learned to be gentle, and I've learned to be tough.
Oh, you must be a liberal.
I found only two things that last till the end.
Nah, you know he's a liberal when
one
he says.
One is your heroes, the other's your friends.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Deaths from cervical cancer can be prevented. They are caused, in most cases, by infection with the human papillomavirus, HPV. There is now a vaccine against this virus, and if you give it to a woman before she's infected, then for her entire life, she will not have the risk of cervical cancer. The problem is that human papillomavirus is most often transmitted, not always, but most often transmitted by sexual activity. And so the paranoid right, the paranoid moralist right, is saying, don't allow this vaccine to be given as part of normal childhood vaccinations, because then our daughters will think that they are safe to have sex. You get how strange this is? Scare at all cost? Anyhow, more on that as time goes on. Roy in Rio Rancho on the line. Hey, Roy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I hope you're not rusting.
I'm not what?
Rusting.
Rusting. Oh, did Louise tell you our roof is leaking in our house?
Well, I spent a week out there a few years ago.
Yeah, it has rained.
I came back and they said, need sunburn. I said, that's not sunburn, that's rust.
There you go. Well, it's funny, you know, the first couple of days that we were here in Portland, whenever it would rain, Louise would go, it's raining again. And I said, no, Louise, what you have to do is start pointing out when the sun comes out instead. Because that's, you know, so now, you know, when the sun comes out, she goes, oh, look, the sun came out. But apparently it's going to be sunny all next week or all this week, which is nice. So hey.
The reason I call, I'm doing an NLP-oriented activate, educate, and motivate seminar in a couple of days.
Oh, how cool.
And
you mean you're teaching it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
And the thing that I'm going to, the key anchor phrase is, where is the morality?
Yeah.
Now, where is the morality? If premarital sex is immoral, where is the morality of letting those kids die because of premarital sex? Where is the morality?
But see, that might scare them enough. See, this is the thing. I mean, the paranoid moralists are so anchored in moving away from pain strategies that they don't understand how powerful moving toward pleasure strategies are. And I think it has to do with childbearing. I think they are the people who were, in all probability, they are the people who were raised by the kind of people who beat their kids, who scare them. And so they go on to scare their kids.
and very judgmental.
Yeah.
And it's very black and white. You know, I mean, we know those things, but it, the folks that I'm talking to is every time that somebody brings up something is look for the morality of what they're talking about or the flip side of the coin. Where's the morality? If we've got to protect the country, where's the morality of killing a bunch of innocent folks in Iraq
right.
in an illegal and immoral war? How is that protecting us, and where is the morality of our justifying doing it?
Well done, Roy. That is
where is the morality?
Yeah. Well, and you can ask that. I mean, you can go right through that top 10
Everything.
Of Bill Frist. You know, where is the morality in tax cuts for the billionaires? Where is it? Absolutely. Well said. Roy, congratulations. Good on you. And
enjoy the Northwest.
Thanks. Hey, is there a website for your real quick?
PosiHD, PosiHD.com.
Great. Okay. Thanks a lot, Roy.
Thanks.
Do good. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. That's me. See you tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
This is Veronique Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug? The phone started ringing.